Guardian Unlimited.
Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen and I'm interviewing Alistair Gray about his novel Lanark. Lanark, I mean, I'm sure everybody here knows, but perhaps I'll just say that it's got this extraordinary structure, which I want to, I suppose, ask you about in a minute. And it has two narratives and two different kinds of narrative, really. One wrapped up in the other. And as a lot of you know, it starts rather like, as I imagine, a book like, I mean, Lawrence Stern would have been very proud of the way it starts, because it starts book three. Okay. And then after you've read book three, which is quite a considerable narrative, you get to the prologue, and then you get to book one, 100-odd pages in. And books one and two, which are at the heart of the novel, are a kind of, I don't know if you'll object to any of these words, they're quite a naturalistic account of a young man growing up in Glasgow in the 50s and trying to be an artist. And they're enwrapped by this narrative of a differently named character inhabiting a kind of fantastic world. You're introduced to a city called Unthank in book three, which begins the story, which is a kind of, you probably will object to this, kind of mixture of Kafka and a science fiction novel.
I don't object to it at all.
Oh. You're the first, I think, your first person at the book club who hasn't objected to my initial description. A very prized guest. Now, I want to can I just start by asking a bit about the history and see if I can get this right, the history of how it grew, because in your on your website, in your CV, you say that book one of Lanark, so that's the first half of Duncan Thor's story of growing up in Glasgow in the 1950s, was actually sent to a literary agent in the early 60s, is that right?
Spencer Curtis Brown!
Yes.
In London. I had finished that bit. I had meant it to be part of this very big, elaborate novel, but my son was about to be born, and we were short of money, and I thought, this section, I think, could stand on its own, perhaps. I sent it to Spencer Curtis Brown. I posted it to Spencer Curtis Brown because they were regarded as the main literary agency in London, with a note saying that this was yet another portrait of the artist as a provincial young man, but I thought there were bits about it that made it different from other portraits of the artist as a provincial young man. Anyway, he wrote back a nice letter, or a letter that came back saying he agreed it was indeed a portrait of the artist of a provincial young man. But he didn't think a portrait of an artist as a provincial young man in Glasgow was any different from a portrait of the artist as a provincial man in Glasgow in Birmingham, Manchester, or any other uninteresting city. And he agreed I was a writer. And if I wrote another book, he'd be quite interested in looking at it. But you know, thinking, you fool Gray, trying to get on to the... you'll just have to carry on and work at what you meant in the first place.
So it's almost another 20 years before the actual the book that we now know was...
I wanted to write a book that would make me very important under the world, as Milton said, would not willingly let to die. I wanted to do that when I was, I think I was 8 or 9 when I began writing a story, and I thought, one day I'll write a story that will be published. And I got a delirious sense of power and authority. It's coming yet for all that. And I thought, I must get it done before I'm 12. I must be a prodigy. I must just stagger people with my intelligence. I kept working trying to write a story that would be better and better and better. And every time I reread it, it was obviously the writing of a child. And then I became an adolescent. and I kept reading what I'd written, and it was obviously the writing of an adolescent. Gosh! Very self-indulgent, you know, terribly bad. Eventually when I went, I had luckily been reading steadily, which is the only way of learning. And I had read The Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man and thought, right, I'll do that for Glasgow instead of Dublin. But I read Kafka's The Castle and the Trial, and I thought, I want to do that for Glasgow as well. It was a different kind of book, and I was kind of writing both of them, or bits of them, fragments about. In my second year at art school, in one of the Glasgow public libraries, I came across Tilliard's book on the background to the English epic. And he explained the epic form of literature, what an epic involved, you know, starting with Homer, Ulysses, the Aeneid, going on to Dante's Divine Comedy, talking about quite a wide range of different books that were trying to give a complete portrait of a whole civilization and how it worked. And he was taking the line that an epic could involve every other genre. That is, it involved ordinary daily domestic life, but big historical changes and movements. It could even take you up to hell and heaven and all that as well, thinking you can fit it all together if you can fit it all together, and therefore the notion of the two different books, the Kafka's Castle Trial plus science fiction, and certain mythological, magical, fantasy kind of things, which I've always been inclined to, could go in with ordinary daily realities that folk ordinarily encounter.
So the whole so that scheme is there right from the beginning. It's not a sort of an early novel wrapped up in a later one. Because that's what some people, I think it is.
Well, I can see why. I think when I started out thinking I could write the Thaw book, it was my second year at art school, which must have been 1953, and I asked my dad if, instead of working as a bus conductor, as most of us did in those days to get money when we were on our school holidays, I could stay at home and work in my novel. And he said, all right. I thought, well, I'll get it finished. And discovered I had no prose style. I managed to get the first chapter of Thaw done, nearly as it's printed, and a wee bit about the hallucination thing, and rather taken aback how difficult it was to work out what I thought was an intelligent prose style. However, he didn't complain. I feel like a rather decent man.
Is he the father? Is he Thor's father?
Yes. But you must understand, I am not a Duncan Thaw. When I planned this book, I was from quite early determined that, unlike Stephen Dedalus, my hero was not going eventually to depart from France to produce a major work of art that would be the conscience of his race. I was going to be tragic. He was going to be mad. He was going to go mad, commit suicide, maybe murder. Because Mad's calling for you. No, it isn't really. It isn't really. But I thought, well, I must make it different. So that's how I'll do it. When I went to Glasgow Art School, I had no intention of committing suicide or going mad or anything like that afterwards. I thought, I'm going to write a book about somebody who does go to Glasgow Art School and does do all these things, and therefore I was keeping copious diaries and taking notes. Actually, my life has been nothing like as miserable as Duncan was. My sister, it uses a lot of things that really did happen, but of course it concentrates on the miserable ones in order to pile on the agony. My sister, who's 2 years younger, who read it, and she said, reading it, she was appalled by it, because she could recognise there was an awful lot of truth in it, but she remembered her childhood as being rather a happy one, and that we'd all got on. There were violent quarrels, as most families do. She started ardently writing down her own memories in order to prevent her memories of the past being overtaken by what I made of the book.
Well, I was going to ask about the one kind of, I think most readers would think, the most central, I don't know, similarity between Duncan Thorne and yourself, because it's a really important part of the story, is that the painting, and not just the painting in general, but the painting of this extraordinary mural that he does in a Presbyterian chapel in Glasgow. And it's a mural of the creation. And it's a mural that's, I mean, I think a lot of you, if you've read it, you'll know what I mean when I say that I had a really strong picture of this, even though going back to it, it wasn't exactly described, or any bits of it were described, but it was described as it was coming alive in his imagination, I suppose. And that, and of course he takes months and months, and he abandons his studies to do it, and there are these incredibly, it seems to be, long-suffering Presbyterian sort of ministers who sort of seem to put up with it. And you did. You're well known for your murals, and you painted a mural, didn't you, Church of Scotland church or something?
I painted murals in two churches of Scotland, one of which has since been demolished. The one that was the creation mural, and a ceiling in a synagogue that has since been demolished. Two murals and buildings that have changed their function and therefore are now under wallpaper.
But it seems a very risky genre to be kind of a lot of time, and it's incredibly hungry of the artist's time, and incredibly risky in terms of preservation.
My intelligence has been largely shaped by an education I got from my dad, who was, I don't think he was as much a reader as me, but he believed people should read and study, and he got lots of books. I won't go into all the details, but he became a member of a book club called the Readers' Union, I don't know if it was every month or every 2 or 3 months, books would arrive in the house, and they were incredibly interesting books. Arthur Whaley's translation of the novel Monkey, his translation of Chinese classical poems, Elizabeth Bowen's The Heart of the Matter was one, Nicholson's study of the Congress of Vienna, which is very funny. One of the books I read was The Horse's Mouth by Joyce Carey. Now, this, if you don't know it, it's a wonderfully funny novel. It describes a situation in, the setting is 1938 or 39. The hero is an artist called Gully Jimson, an old man in his late 60s who's had a very turbulent career trying to develop his talent in Britain, mainly without success, but he's had a period in which he painted oil paintings that people liked and dealers liked. But then he discovered the works of William Blake and realised that the kind of paintings he should be making were very big mural paintings about everything. And therefore, of course, it becomes quite unsaleable, because you can't sell walls, at least dealers can't. It's a wonderfully funny novel. He's presented as ruthlessly selfish, but since he's practically no money, and it starts with him being let out of jail because he's been making threatening phone calls to his dealer. You can't help being on his side because he's standing up for himself and his art quite ruthlessly, but in a situation of actually no support or advantage except a friendly postman who approves of him just because the postman's a radical and thinks that people who are in a low sedition position should be approved of. And it's a funny and very wise book, and he keeps describing the paintings he wants to make. And Joyce Carey had been to Edinburgh College of Art, so he was able to imagine how painters would imagine paintings. He keeps quoting Blake because he's memorised all the Blake he wants, and as a result of that, that taught me about William Blake. I went to Glasgow Mitchell Library, where they have facsimiles of Blake's original books and even some examples of it. But it left me with a very strong idea that the most heroic thing an artist could do was paint a major work of great importance for people who didn't give a damn for it. And if they came along and knocked it down, that was their affair. So you weren't to blame. You were just getting on with you were just getting on with the only right thing that you could do. Anything I am, I owe to Joyce Carey is the horse's mouth.
Well, you you actually tell us, Joyce Carey, if we didn't know that, if you've read Lanark, you kind of find out a bit about that, don't you? Because, as probably most of you know, halfway through the last book of Lanark, actually Alistair comes in with, in your own person, really, with an epilogue in which you kind of not only talk about the book and the passing generosity of the Scottish Arts Council and the help of people who've typed it, but you also provide what I think rather sort of cruelly to yourself, you call an index of plagiarisms, which, it's a literary debts, really. And one of the ones, which I just wanted to ask you about, because I haven't at all seen it, but you say in the index of plagiarisms, it's sort of one of the things which gave you the idea for this extraordinary structure of the book. And when you mentioned it, I thought, oh, yes, of course, which is Charles Kingsley's The Water Babies.
Oh, yes.
I don't know if people here are familiar with it, which is a book extraordinarily... It's about a chimney sweep.
Oh, yes.
It's a Victorian children's classic. And it's kind of divided between the sort of account of the horrors and privations of being a chimney sweep in Victorian London. And then he sort of drowns, doesn't he? Drowns.
Exactly.
And just like your protagonist. And then he goes into this kind of weird water world, doesn't he?
Yes, it's a mixture of... he goes into a world that is partly based on Kingsley's reading of Darwin.
Yeah.
And I would almost say Buddhism, because he...
Did he know about Buddhism?
Oh yes, he would. Yeah. Quite a few people did then. In fact, there was an English. He became a major magistrate in India, but he was converted to Tibetan Buddhism, I think in the 1830s or 40s, and wrote a book about it. But when Tom has been drowned and he is resurrected as a water baby, which is a kind of water nymph or insect, and he gradually starts off by being a rather selfish bad boy, but an element of Pinocchio here. he finds that as a selfish bad boy, he starts growing prickles.
Yeah, he becomes a kind of sea anemone.
Urchin more, so that the fairies who the goddesses who preside over this world, Mrs. Do as you would be done by.
Yeah.
And who's a nice big motherly lady, can't cuddle him because he's full of prickles, which he's developed because he's been selfishly nasty for fun to other creatures. And then her alternative, who turns out to be the same person really, Mrs. Be Done By As You Did, turns up and explains, what can you expect if you're carrying on like that?
So is that what gave you the idea for Lanark growing these kind of dragonish scales?
Partly, but also I was liable, still am slightly, to eczema, and therefore and grew scales myself. It was a mixture of different things, but certainly I was 7 or 8. I was living in Wetherby in Yorkshire, where my dad had a job during the Second World War. And in the schoolroom of the church school in Wetherby, there was a cupboard which, when it was rainy, they opened it and we could take out books. And they had a lot of Victorian children's thingamajigs that I read with great avidity. George MacDonald's The Golden Key, which I think another great story. And of course I was Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. Anything fantastic and magic I was scooped up. I wasn't interested in cowboys and Indians. I wasn't interested in public schools or the boys of Greyfriars. I thought, oh, that's just how adults carry on. Boring. Utterly boring. I only wanted magic and fantasy. It took me a wee while to realise that Dickens and Thomas Hardy and James Joyce, etc., were writing about worlds that were just as fantastic and interesting, though not at all fantastically magic.
Okay, and the fantasy world, and Umthank. Mm. Does one? I mean, this is a very sort of basic question. Do you need to know Glasgow to really recognise that world?
I would hope not.
No, because everybody talks about it as a sort of nightmare kind of distorted vision of a real place.
I would hope that I believe people can enjoy Kafka's trial without having been to Prague, and that they might enjoy Lanark without having been to Glasgow. There's a number of features. The Glasgow I grew up in the 1950s and 60s was a heavily industrial city based upon coal, steam power, steam engines, steam trains, largely steam-powered ships. And as a result, an awful lot of smoke.
Yeah, there's no daylight in Unthank, is there? Little slither.
The point was that there was, and by the way, the same thing may have been true of Birmingham and Manchester, for all I know, there was always quite, there tended to be, well, thick fogs, but also a heavy layer of cloud above the city. It's in a valley, so that when the layer of cloud was thick, you could look to the Campsie Hills to the north, or the Cathkenbries to the south, and you'd see underneath the cloud ceiling a line of light that indicated there was a different weather going on on the other side of the hills to the north and to the south. And it was indeed very dark at night because of this. There was a thing called the Glasgow Fair when the industries shut down for a fortnight, and the smoke cleared, and therefore if you went to the higher hills, you could see the range of Highland mountains to the north. And I do remember on the way to school, and one day we looked up and saw, you could see the disk of the sun through the grey cloud, and it was undoubtedly bluish-green. There was discussions about it. It turned out there had been a forest fire in Canada, which was the cause of this. It wasn't just local to Glasgow. But then again, in other ways, during the winter months, when it was very foggy and dull, you would see the disk of the sun, a very strong blood orangey colour. And I can remember one particular occasion in which you could actually see sunspots on it, two definite wee dots. Anyway, this local variation no doubt produced the notion of a city in which the sun only rose for a few minutes. and you never knew when, and it would start going down again. And what's more, nobody was particularly interested in it. there were fantasy elements in every. For instance, there is one of the fantasy chapters. I think it's called A Zone, in which the character Lanark and his partner, or as we used to say, wife, start trying to leave a place by walking along a road through a very thick fog, and they discover to their surprise that the road is a line down the middle of it, and they're walking side by side down this road, which has no traffic, but they suddenly discover that on one side one of them is travelling very fast and the other very slowly, because though the levels seem exactly the same, on one side the sensation is of going downhill and the other side is going uphill. And therefore it's very difficult for them to stay together. And if you're going downhill, you get so fast that you're liable to fall down. So they realise the best way is to hold hands over the line in the middle, which means that when one's going uphill, when one's going downhill, they're helping the one that's on the going uphill side, and vice versa. Good idea, except it puts a terrible strain on the arm. It never occurred to me. I thought, when I was writing this, I thought, oh, that's highly entertaining. Good idea. It never occurred to me what it was maybe about, and then I realised it was about being the first year in a marriage. Because as I remember in my first year in a marriage, or a year or two, occasionally we were short of money, and one of us would think of, come on, let's have a good time, let's splurge, let's... And we would, and then there'd be no money left, and we'd have to find out and borrow. What was necessary was that when I felt like spending money heartily, my wife would say, oh, no, you can't do that. Or when she felt like spending money heartily, I'd say, oh, no, you can't do that. Put a terrible strain on a marriage. In a marriage, you have to compensate for each other in order to just keep going along an ordinary way. But while you're doing it, you're putting a terrible strain, because who likes compensating for somebody else, particularly if you love them? They should be supporting you all the way, all the time. It was only, I think, a few years after I'd written that chapter, it occurred to me. I was describing in a kind of metaphor for the first year of all, I think, well, of my marriage and probably other people's.
It's funny that you discovered that that's what it meant, because actually I must throw it open in a minute. But the last question I wanted to ask was about the relationship of your two protagonists, really, with the female characters, and you've described that that one of Lanark with Rima, but in the Duncan Thor narrative. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's funny because in your illustrations, both the front cover that Claire proudly held up, beginning of a sort of strong naked woman rising from the Clyde with the sun in her hands, but then the opening title page for the first book three, here are all these female spirits or deities or personifications of experience and truth, and then a woman holding up a magnificently armoured Amazon holding up the globe, Magistra Vitae, Mistress of Life.
Yes.
And here you have all these kind of female tutelary spirits, if that's the right phrase. But in the story, especially in Duncan Thor's story, he's always pursuing or being perplexed by these female characters, isn't he? And there's the impossible Marjorie, who's this sort of the woman he's courting, who does... He's allowed to hold her hand on the bus, isn't he? But sort of nothing ever more comes. She's always kind of saying she'll sort of model for him and never doing it. And and always apparently sort of leading him on with the very slightest of possible encouragements. And then there's sort of, there's June, the portly one, he bumps into on the tram about once a year, and she always says, meet me on the Partick Road on that windy street corner. And he always goes there and she never comes. I mean, is there a sort of... I mean, why is it that that he, and I think Lanark too, I mean, you've talked about the image of marriage, but he has a child, but the woman immediately, his wife, goes off and leaves him. They seem to pursue these female incarnations of their ideals, and they but they're absolutely sort of hopeless pursuits.
Yep.
So that's, I'm right, I've got that right, have I?
Oh, I think so, yes. No, I mean, it's partly autobiographical. I grew up in a respectable working class housing scheme, and like most people who grew up in respectable middle class housing schemes, I assumed I was utterly middle class, because we had a postman and a nurse and a printer and the local tobacconist up our close. And therefore, we were the people who were keeping the country going. I was quite taken aback when, in later years at art school, I met people who'd been to tea-paying schools and they regarded me as an inferior social status. I didn't think such people existed. quoting a bit from that book there, we took it for granted, my parents took it for granted, that the highest forms of social life was a doctor who was fighting disease. A doctor, certainly. Nurses also. A Labour councillor, or a Labour MP, a Labour politician who was fighting poverty and for social equality. Probably a lawyer who's fighting for justice and fair play for everyone. And that, if you were from a working class background, if you could become, a teacher, who's of course fighting ignorance. These were the four best things you could possibly be. Of course, most people had to keep the country going by making clothes and houses and making food. We honestly, under the welfare state and the Butler Acts that have been brought in by a coalition, mainly Tory government at the end of the war, we felt that Britain was a socialist nation which was superior to the USSR because it was a democracy that was not dominated by a single party government, and superior to the USA because it wasn't ruled by millionaire businessmen. And therefore, Britain was showing the way to the future, and a splendid example of it. It was really a bit shocking growing out of that assumption. I still almost cannot believe it, he said, bursting into tears.
And meeting all those kind of those, they're hilariously drawn, the art students, the female art students, and the guys with berets, and...
They were... it was wonderful.
So you weren't. It wasn't as miserably frustrating for you as it was for Duncan Thorpe.
Oh no, not at all. No. I was making him a tragic hero. So I had to make him. I was quite adaptable. I did annoy and quarrel with my teachers. But they were most upset by me. But I found ways of letting them down gently. They didn't dismiss me. They actually got me a travelling scholarship. You know, alas, they didn't employ me as one of themselves. But you kind of expect that. Because I was inventing somebody who had to be tragic, I invented somebody who was a lot tougher, a lot nastier, and even, I think, slightly more selfish than I am. So, I'm not sure of that.
Well, let's give anybody here the chance to ask Alistair about whatever it is, what particular bit of Lanark you need explaining. He'll explain any part of it, yes?
Alistair, in 1947, in my working class childhood, I spent a year in Lanark in a Catholic orphanage. And I was interested when you used the Lanark. And also, the other thing, I grew up in the most sectarian town outside Glasgow called Belsill, and there was a place called Unthank Road.
Yes.
And I was interested when you used Unthank, because in fact, Unthank Road was where the Orangemen were.
I think it was 1958 or 59, I was teaching an art teacher in a secondary school, a Catholic one, in, I think it was New Stevenson. But I was going out there by bus. We passed through a variety of mining towns that were in not very rich condition, and this was the year in which Pope, and the great Pope, Liberal Pope John, was being consecrated, or made the Pope, and. And as the bus went along, I saw on the end of a tenement gable, somebody had written up the words, when was the Battle of the Boyne?
1690.
Yes. 1690!
Stand up when you say it.
1690! Unthank will never surrender! You know, think, what is Unthank got to surrender? that word, which I never come across, but what a wonderful word. I've since heard that there are several unthanks in Britain. It's a Saxon word, and there are unthanks in England. Basically, the word thank in this sense means tax. Well, it actually means unthank means you can't get any money out of this place. It's too fair. I thought it was such a wonderful name that I thought I should use it.
I read an article saying that complimenting you for your brilliant etymological wit in choosing that and giving precisely this kind of history, which. The critics supposed was kind of there in place before you ever kind of used the name.
Mm-hmm. Outside in the foyer, there's a box set of Lanark, which is in the volumes. Would it be... I was thinking of getting it for somebody who... A young person who I know will love it. Would it be criminally irresponsible to give them a box set on the basis that they will probably order it 1 to 4, not start with 3? There's a serious point behind this. How important is it that you read book 3 first?
I don't think it's important. I have suggested to folk because there are folk who say they find the fantasy a bit difficult and they don't enjoy it much. And I say, well, read it 1, 2, 3, 4. You might find it more easy. I really do. I did 3, 1, 2, 4, partly out of a sense of utter cheek, as an annoying device that would draw people's attention to the book. But in fact, I also when I did start writing it, when I did decide that I was going to combine the two books into one, I had initially meant the Lanark. What you might call the fantasy metaphorical bit to be inside the Thor section, but as time passed, that bit grew bigger and bigger and bigger, and I thought, no, better reverse it, and then, as has been pointed out in many epics, the Iliad and the Aeneid, they say. Media res, you start in the middle, and then you've a flashback to explain how you got here. Later on, and then you run on to the end. which is what Milton, to a great to some extent, did in Paradise Lost, and because he was following what Homer had done in the Iliad and then the Odyssey and Virgil in the Aeneid, and for that matter, Scott Fitzgerald does it in his first version of Tender as the Night, which I think is a great book, novel, and thinking, let's be classical, and use this funny numbering.
Alistair, how do you feel that Lanark relates to your later writing?
I think my novel 1982, Janine, is a better novel, a better work of art, and I think it's about a third or a quarter of the length. I wrote it, I think, in less than a year, quite rapidly. I thought it was going to be a short story, and it expanded and expanded and expanded. I think it's a far better work of art. It also has a great advantage, in that the central character is not another bloody artist. I think I made him quite a convincing electrical engineer, and although since the time of Wordsworth, you've got so many artists writing about people who are being artists or writers, I think writers ought not to be writing about themselves, but about people who can be identified more broadly with everybody. I think 1982, Janine is my best novel. But I'm not sorry people enjoy. I'm not sorry Lanark's still in print.
An influence of science fiction on the kind of fantasy elements has been alluded to. Could you expand a bit on that, on what sort of books you'd been reading and how they worked their way in to Lanark?
It started with only being interested in fairy tales and magic and fantasy. Started reading, of course, Greek legends, and like most of us in those days, we were given bits of the Bible, and there you've got a lot of people flying up into the air, and animals talking in human hands, and miraculous occurrences. I didn't like reality, you see, like most children, or what is given as reality, and therefore I read all the fairy tales and things I could. And then, as I matured, if that's what it was, 11 or 12, Conan Doyle's The New World. The BBC in those days did wonderful sound radio broadcasts of things like H.G. Wells's The War of the Worlds and Conan Doyle's The Lost World and things like that. And I think, wonderful. Of course, there was the Disney films that I loved. And the earlier ones, Pinocchio, Dumbo Jumbo, etc., and all that fantasy stuff I loved. And then gradually science fiction. I started reading H.G. Wells's because he really is the best of all the. Though his fantasies were written about 1900, they've never been surpassed. And you generally find that most science fiction novels nowadays are taking some wee element that he explored and expanding it hugely, as I say, of course, I had started with Hans Andersen's fairy tales, I think, and Hans Andersen is a uniquely good writer. His fairy tales are not. Nobody makes Christmas pantomimes out of the little match girl, which ends with her dying of cold and hunger. they don't even use political satires like the Emperor's New Clothes or the Princess of the Pea. They're terribly radical, biting political stuff, and his stories are full of. Often a terrible sense of loss, and involve death, not like Aladdin or Cinderella or all the stuff with the happy endings, and yet children quite naturally like them, because actually they're they're more worried about the adult world than we're supposed to think. But what I mean is that you realise that in these fantasies there are actually rather convincing shadows of how the world is. They may exaggerate. The main exaggeration is describing some people as being utterly evil or utterly good, which is never the case. But nonetheless, if you're small and young, you do encounter people who, as far as you're concerned, are utterly evil toward you, or sometimes utterly good. Or again, there's the shift, sometimes one, sometimes the other. And in these magic fantasy stories and things, you're actually being prepared for the kind of world you're going to have to face. I've never liked Lord of the Rings, because that's based on the assumption that there are completely evil races of people, and completely orcs, or completely evil classes of people, the bad magicians. You know, none of that's really true, but it's quite relaxing to go into a world in which it seems to be true, and then you don't have to think. just clap the good folk who win.
I was just wondering, I discovered your books and Russell Hoban's at about the same time in my life, and there often seem to be. My mind often drew parallels between his books and yours, and the way female characters turn out or end up or seem to be in his books and yours, and characters wandering off into worlds that they shouldn't really have wandered into in his books and yours. And I was just wondering whether you had any thought about that or anything.
I've read a few of his books and enjoyed them. The Ridley Walker, and then the one about the turtles.
Ridley Walker's brilliant.
Yeah. Oh yes, his invention of a post catastrophe language is a kind of form of late Cockney is wonderful, because you read it and thought, I've never read language like this before, but I understand it perfectly. I've only read a few of his books. I like them because I feel he's humane, so I like his writing.
I just wanted to ask you about your illustrations, which I think in all your books I think are really remarkable, and really give, you know, my whole sense of Lanark comes from your illustrations as well as the writing. At what stage do they come into it? Do you draw them as you're going along, or are they just purely something that you add at the end?
No, title pages to Lanark. I got the idea of those, and I'm not quite sure of the date. It was, I think, sometime in the 1960s. I was visiting London. I was visiting the British Museum to do research into a play that had been commissioned by Granada for a series called Queen Victoria's Scandals, and it was research into a Church of England clergyman who'd broken away to found his own religious sect. In fact, I turned the play that I wrote into a novella, which is in this book. But visiting the British Museum in order to read the man's, I only discovered a year or two ago. I could have found it in Glasgow University Library. But I thought you could only get them from the British Museum, you know, his published diaries and things. So I got a temporary ticket and was down in London. And while I was visiting the British Museum, there were postcards. And I found there was the postcard to the frontispiece for Walter Raleigh's History of the World, postcards for the frontispiece of Roger Bacon's Novum Organum. You had these brilliant emblematic title pages to 17th century works of scientific erudition and this and that, and I thought, that's what I want for my book. And therefore I got reproductions of them, and I redrew them. I used as little as possible imagination and invention as I could. I had to redraw them a bit, to make them fit the page, and also with wee changes to make it suit what I was doing. But as I say, they are mainly obvious plagiarisms of works by a greater and graver than myself. Because there's no point in inventing something that's worse than you can get if you pinch properly.
I recently started your latest book, which I'm really enjoying, actually, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that.
You mean Old Men in Love?
Yes.
Yes. Mm.
That started because I was short of money. When wanting to write a new book and without ideas for more, I can honestly say I've never suffered from writer's block, which I gather is a form of constipation in which you feel you've got a lot of stuff inside you, but you can't get it out. And in general, when I've got no ideas for other books, it's because I've got no stuff inside me that I want to get out. And therefore, writing another book, there were three plays that I'd worked upon. Two were actually produced by Granada Television in the early 70s. One about the trial of Socrates in a thing called For Conscience Sake, a series about religious trials. Another in Queen Victoria's Scandals about the Reverend Henry Prince. I also had an idea I wanted to write a play about Fra Filippo Lippi, the muralist in Renaissance Florence. I did some sketches for it. That was never commissioned. But I thought, another book. Right, a trilogy. Three historical trilogies called Men in Love. One about Socrates, one about Filippo Lippi, one about the Reverend Henry James Prince. And anyway, I started writing it and ran into difficulties. I got quite a few chapters about Pericles in Athens, and then I wanted to describe Aristophanes, a friend of Socrates, did a satirical play called The Clouds, in which he presents Socrates as a money-grubbing pederast who makes money out of silly rich young men by filling their heads full of philosophical nonsense. Oddly enough, they seem never to have quarrelled over this. One of the reasons seems to have been that Aristophanes knew that Socrates wouldn't bring a libel action against them, and Aristophanes was out to make fun of the sophists, who were philosophers who went about doing what he thought that we presented Socrates doing, but if he'd mocked them, they would have brought a libel action, so he decided he'd use Socrates instead. That seems to be the explanation. Apparently the play was largely a flop, because Socrates attended every performance and stood up in the audience so that people could see the difference between him and the man who was acting on stage. I'm going to make my own translation of this play and present it as a chapter. I read it and I couldn't get the jokes. And they were obviously contemporary jokes, utterly contemporary. Aye, contemporary jokes, but that's 2,500 years ago. And you can't, I'm thinking, I can't do this. What can I do? Drop it and carry on with the other one. I wobbled back and forward and then thought, how can I do this? And then I thought, it's a bit on the mechanical side, three separate historical plays. And I got the idea of, I'll do it like the Arabian Nights. I'll invent an author who isn't me, but is like me trying to write these books. And sometimes gets things right and sometimes to give it up. So I got the idea of John Tunnock inventing a retired Glasgow primary school headmaster who's retired in early life, who's never had much actually life because he's grown up, looked after by spinster aunts and has actually had no sex life at all till they've died. And then when he starts picking up young things, as he calls them, in Bowers Road. Terrible man. No wonder he gets killed in the end. But then the notion of inventing this character who's trying to write these books that I was trying to write and failing to write, but I would show the bits of them, but also having his diary in which explains his life while he's at work in it. And I thought, what is it? Well, I started enjoying writing it like that but I can perfectly understand why practically all the reviews have been very friendly. Even the Financial Times had a very friendly review that by somebody who liked the book, but said, "It is obvious that Alistair Gray is a writer, but he is not a novelist." all his characters are versions of himself, except the stroppy females. He's quite good at describing stroppy females. I'm saying, if you want to read his work, Old Men in Love is as good a place to start as any, but he's not a novelist. Well, that's all right.
Alistair said before we started that at the end, you said you wanted to do a little 5-minute reading, yes?
Well, something completely different. A month or two ago, this came to my mind, which is some rhymed verses. Somebody asked me, "Why did you write that?" I haven't the faintest idea. It's called The Ballad of Anne Bonny. And I am, by the way, a Scot who would like Scotland to have a government as independent as England as is possible. I know it's impossible. You can't have two governments in one big island without them being utterly independent. But at the same time, I'm not Anglophobic. and for some reason writing this, I found it was coming out in an R. Jimmy Ladd, Robert Newton, or even Pirates of the Caribbean voice. though I haven't heard the film, but "Blind and a beggar, sir, also a sot that tells tall tales. Who'd buy me drink, did I not? Don't sit too near. I stink, but crave brandy, though beer will do. Thanks. Long life to us both. How I became thus, you will hear. A woman caused it. Anne Bonny by name, a little tough sailor, same as me then, but 20 years older. Dressed as a man, she'd swab decks, climb masts, reef sails, swear like the rest of us, dodging land, law, family. She had pluck. Shame that her name did not fit her face, but young men will fuck holes in planks. Those who sought swings in Anne's hammock drove her mad. She broke my nose, being keen on a lad of 14 who thought her a joke. Queer how shy Anne was with him near, unable to speak or look at him straight, yet mending his breeks and scaring off buggers after his bum. On yard arms, she was the chum who steadied him. His head for height was poor. He cried at night, like me, years before when I joined ship. I was whipped and ain't shed tears since. Who'd whip the young prince? We called him that. Must thrash Anne Bonny first. Nobody durst. It was bad for the lad, being loved like a cub by a tigress. No rumpy pumpy. Anne's motherly rage cut that out. But boys past the age of 10 need men to teach them men's ways. Aye, you winked, sir. Think me a sod. More beer, and I'll explain your mistake. My thanks. Hard lives don't make all men brutes. At sea, we survive by helping each other. Had the prince been ugly, he could still have trusted me like a brother. His looks showed he knowed he'd fare better if Anne pulled out her hooks. When she was nigh, not nigh, some would cry, "How's your wife the princess today?" Or, "No beard this morning, sir? I suppose the Queen Mother shaved you before you arose." If he sneezed, "Wrap up well. If you catch cold, the royal nurse will give us all hell." He'd go white, would yell, "That ain't fair. I don't need, don't want, don't like that old woman," when Anne was not there. At last I said, "Stow that gab." Thrashed Abe the Yid, who joshed him most. Leclerc the next who did would feel my fist. The prince looked up to me then, and too. She shook my hand. I commanded the main topsail. Anne got the first mate to let the prince and she serve under me. On the first day, Abe the Yid cries, "Look up there, see aloft in the cross tree, ma, pa, baby, a holy family, all complete, how sweet." I blacked his eyes. So before her last breath, Anne did not know I wanted her death, which I did not plan. A stiff breeze struck sudden and hard while we put about on a starboard tack and reefed in smart. But Anne, not quite secure, thrust out her hand, sure of my aid. I just gazed back till her amazed face filled with fear as her other hand lost hold. Clawing, clawing ere she fell, 80 feet or more, smack onto the deck without a yell. That kind of end ain't uncommon at sea, but was near me. The prince alone knew what I'd failed to do, so was no more my friend. That I'd failed Anne to make him a man, he could not see. Others too grew strange to me. I changed also. No longer sprang lightly aloft, but had to force myself up. I'd lost my pluck, which is most of a seaman's luck. In 2 days I became the glum, numb, dumb Jonah of the crew. Before the next point of my tale, I need fortified by brandy, not ale. My thanks to you, sir. When mending rigging, a handy tool is an iron fork, the space between prongs wide as eyes in a face. One night I woke in dreadful pain and darkness and never saw light again, but lay below deck like a log for weeks, wishing those prongs had pierced my brain. Who had blinded me, I neither cared nor knew. But my old mates grew kind now I was blind, brought me grub, baccy, grog. The prince was now topmast's king. He sometimes bathed what were once my eyes, not saying much, but I knew his touch. Abe, a Scotch Jew, so doubly weird, sat by me, talking of God, who he called Needcessity. Once I asked, slightly curious, "Did you blind me, Abe?" And he said sternly, "That question is spurious. The past is unquestionable. Your job is embracing now, anyhow. Forget your eyes. Days before losing them, you stopped rightly using them. We all miss Anne, but are glad you ain't dead. 2 murders on 1 trip is bad for a ship." Great gladness filled me then. It stays to this day. Confessing how vile I was is pleasant, I admit. My punishment justifies it. Since coming ashore, I begged from door to door, pub to pub, enjoying life how I can. A harmless old man. This dismal tale may not seem worth the price of the liquor you fed me, sir. I disagree, and you need not believe it, unlike me.
Well, you heard it here first. Well, just to say, you're going to get another round of applause, actually, now, I think, Alistair, because I just wanted to say thank you very much, not just for that, but for coming and talking to us and answering my sometimes misdirected questions. And Alistair, I'm sure you'll sign some books, yes, if people like that. And just to say, thanks very much.
Guardian Unlimited.